Welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. At my side is the lovely Zilpha. Hi, Zilpha.
Hello, John. Hello, everybody.
We're back with another exciting one I've been looking forward to for some time. Of course, we all know about our polygamist roots, and most of us are vaguely aware that it's still going on. Of course, you know, you have the folks down at the border, Warren Jeffs and his group that are always hitting the headlines. But polygamy is still with us in many, many ways, and is a lot more complicated than just what you read in the headlines, as most of y'all know. So tonight, we're going to be talking to Sanjeev
Bhattacharya.
Bhattacharya, right? Sanjeev Bhattacharya, is that right, Sanjeev?
That is absolutely right. Spoken like a native.
Well, now Sanjeev, first of all, with the name and the accent, you're not one that most people would associate with Mormon polygamy. So what strange course of events led you to this place in your life?
Exactly. It's just, an unfortunate series of accidents. And now, I came to the States and when anybody moves country, they think, you know, there's an adventure ahead of them. But there's no way I would ever have thought that, you know, I'd end up immersed in the world of Mormon polygamy for for years and years. But, you know, I haven't had a very planned life, so I suppose things like this sort of happen. I started off as a journalist for a magazine journalist in the UK. I was writing sort of features for Sunday supplements and things like that, and also lifestyle magazines like GQ and so on. So I worked for GQ for a while, left, and, you know, it's a bit too long a story, but I ended up in Los Angeles. It was probably not a very wise decision, but once you arrive, it's sunny all the time. You can't really leave. You've got to have your adventure. So I just continued being a freelance journalist, writing for people in the States, and various magazines, you know, a little bit for the LA Weekly, a little bit for the Los Angeles Times, a bit for Details magazine, but a lot of clients as well in the UK, where I had started out my career. So magazines like Marie Claire, The Telegraph, The Times, The Observer, Guardian, and so on. So I'm constantly looking for interesting stories that are happening in the States that I can sell to the UK, which is fascinated in America. Even more fascinated, I think, while I was when I began this, you know, this work on polygamy, because there was this fascination in the George Bush presidency, which was looked upon in the UK. It's like, oh my God, what are they doing? What's happening to that country? And so there was a lot of curiosity in things like, you know, American religion. You know, he was this kind of evangelical president, and suddenly there was all this religious language involved in the politics, made everybody very nervous, you know, in the UK. And so the world of American religions had become very interesting. And Under the Banner of Heaven came out. Mm-hmm. The FLDS situation was ramping up. You know, Warren Jeffs' reign had just begun. And I started writing stories about it. So I did, I think, a couple for Marie Claire, one for The Telegraph. One thing sort of led to the other, you know. This was all happening. The story kept changing. The temple in Texas was being built at the time. So I managed to sort of parlay this Mormon thing and get a bit deeper and deeper into the world of the FLDS and Warren Jeffs, made a documentary. And I sort of got closer and closer and closer to this topic and met a lot of people involved in this world. And once I'd finished the documentary, I had this sense of frustration. I think a lot of people have that when they do something on TV, because they think, oh, you know, we could have done so much of a better job, so much more to say. And we've created a piece of entertainment rather than something really important. And I thought,
I thought your documentary, mm-hmm. It was more than just entertaining. It's on the web. If any of you listeners are interested, it's called The Man with 80 Wives. and it's available for free, right? Just on the web.
Yeah, it's on my website. You know, if you go to sanjivb.com and look under documentary, you can see the whole thing. I'm glad you enjoyed it. It was great fun to make. But at the same time, you know, it's an hour, and it was focused on this one man and this one group and this very sort of narrow story, as sensational and incredible as it was. And I'd become aware that while all of the attention was focused on the FLDS, there was this kind of underbelly of quiet polygamists who were watching this whole drama play out with great interest and feeling quite nervous about the whole thing. And really nobody was paying any attention to them, and they seemed equally relevant. And once you start looking under that rock, it doesn't stop getting more and more interesting. So it just completely sucked me in.
Yeah, it's sort of it's a secret that those of us in Utah or a section of us in Utah like to keep under wraps. But, you know, Zilpha and I live here in Lehi, Utah, and not a half a mile away from our house are obvious compounds, you know, with 7 car garages and multiple homes. And I'm sure at the elementary school our children go to, there are children of polygamists around here. And as you drive up and down the I-15 corridor, there's enclaves, little towns that are just right on the side of the mountain where they're full of compounds, and everybody knows those are all the polygamists. I mean, they're here, they're with us. And because the church so much wants to make them the other, it just gets sort of brushed over. But it's the thing that everybody knows about, who knows what's going on.
We don't really want to, or many of us don't want to think about it or really pay attention to it. But
yeah, I can understand that. It's a really amazing thing that all the time that I spent in Utah, the number of just everyday people, you know, who would have stories to tell about actual polygamists that they knew, or people who had left the culture that they'd know, or people who had just entered the culture. And it was so real and so kind of personal and so much part of the landscape, like you're saying, that, I mean, you know, people in Utah are so close to it. It seemed incredible that this, it still staggers me that these stories are not much more widely known, because, I mean, for example, the head of the order, the Kingston, it goes by many names, and I think they like to call themselves the Davis County Cooperative Society, because it just sounds like an organization, a cooperative. It doesn't sound religious at all. But most people colloquially call them the Kingstons, because they're dominated by one family, the Kingston family, over generations. But within the group, they call themselves the Order. They always have done. They don't like other people calling them the Order, but they always have done. So the Order, the head of the Order, the prophet of the Order, Paul Kingston, I was speaking to a member of his family who, obviously I can't reveal, but I'm still in touch. It's one of the few people that I'm still in touch with since doing the research many years ago. And he says, and I have to preface everything here, I don't have the proof. I can't prove this in a court of law. You know, this is all allegedly. But then again, your readers can, you know, do what they want with this information. But he said, and he's a member of Paul Kingston's family, he's a nephew. He said that Paul Kingston has in the region 400 children at the moment.
Wow.
You know, it's astonishing that this isn't more widely known.
Well, I can tell you, I have some personal experience. Years ago, back in the 90s, I worked for the Bountiful Police Department. The Bountiful is the suburb that's just north of Salt Lake, where a lot of the Kingstons live. And they were tracked and well-known by the police department, but they would always outwit the police department. And I've heard they bantered about that the Kingstons are organized crime. Now, I'm no lawyer, but I know that many of the same activities, you know, that mark like New Jersey style organized crime, like they control a lot of the bail bonds shops in the state of Utah. They control a lot of the garbage disposal companies, and they just have their hands in a lot of things that nobody would think they have their hands in. And while their businesses may not be overtly illegal, they tend to trade in child labor and other off the books dealings. I'm sure you have a little bit to say on that.
Well, absolutely. I think that the Order is just one of the most incredible groups, one of the most incredible stories, and I do think that once it receives the kind of attention I think it deserves nationally, the kind of scrutiny that I think I think I would welcome, and I think a lot of people would welcome, then it's going to be a seismic, it's going to be a story on the scale of Warren Jeffs and the FLDS. It's every bit as sinister, every bit as distasteful, and frankly, very, very disturbing. What makes the story about the Order all the more disturbing is that the FLDS live on compounds. They wear prairie dresses. You can spot them. You know, these women look like they're part of that culture. They may be plural wives, and you're likely to be right if you're, you know, within, if you're at the shops near the compound, then you'll probably spot a FLDS member quite successfully. But the Order is scattered through Salt Lake County and north, Bountiful, particularly like you mentioned. I think that's where some of the leadership live. They have their annual picnic and so on. They wear the same clothes. That it's part of their mission to look like regular citizens so that nobody will suspect that they are members of the Order. The children seldom know who their parents are, who their father is, because it would give away that they are Kingstons. So they pick surnames out of the telephone book so that the kids at school and kids in society are not going to know that they are Kingstons, even though they are. And the kids themselves aren't told that their father, for example, may be Paul Kingston or John Daniel Kingston, who are very senior members of the church. So they'll be going to church venerating people like Paul Kingston, saying that, you know, he is God's chosen messenger on earth. He's, you know, their savior, without realizing that they're actually his, that he's their dad. He's not just their prophet, he's their dad. And they won't have a dad for many years. This is one of the very minor crimes of the Kingstons, but they deprive these children of fathers for many years, and they tell them lies to tell other people, and they start them lying very early on. They say that just tell the other kids that your father is at war, so he's away, and so that's why nobody sees him. Or he's a long-haul truck driver, so he's constantly away. They realize that these stories are not true, but they tell them anyway because they want to be obedient. And then at roughly the point where it's they're old enough for their hearts to be completely broken and very confused, they discover, inevitably, they always do, they discover that, no, actually, you're one of like 300 children of one of these very senior members of the group. This is not a functional society. It's horrendous. And all of the things that you mentioned about child labor and so on, child labor has been part of the Order. It's been a sort of an unquestioned part of the Order. It's sort of, to mention child labor to Order members, they can't believe that this is really an issue that's really coming up, like this is something that people really care about. And I think, for the most part, it's because their other crimes against children are so horrific that they would much rather you look at child labor. It's a surprise that people care about child labor when really their crime against children is incest. Mm. This is what the Order practices. It's not that incest is permissible under certain circumstances. It's that it is preferred. It's the way that God would prefer it in order
so that
to
keep they're all pure. Kingstons?
Yes, so that the bloodline of the pure Order members can remain pure and unpolluted. So this is, and again, this comes from extensive interviews with people who have left the group but have been part of incestuous relationships that they were encouraged to be in, or they're the product of incestuous relationships, and they have horror stories to tell.
So when you say incest, are you talking about cousins or are you talking closer?
Closer. Allegedly, Paul Kingston, and this comes from numerous sources, not just one or two, is said to be married to a whole string of his half-sisters. That's, you know, doesn't get a lot closer than that. There are also uncle-niece is very common. It's also very dangerous because of the sort of it corrupts that relationship between an uncle and a niece, which is generational. So that's a problem which actively victimizes young girls.
How young is it common for them to marry off the young ladies?
Well, it's difficult to say. There are specific cases where girls have talked about, I think there are cases as young as 13 and 14 that I'm aware of. But the practice, the sort of the road to that marriage and the corruption often begins before that. I mean, what it's done within the Kingston group has normalized the sexualization of younger and younger girls. There was a family in, I'm going to forget the actual district. It's just outside, I think it's West Jordan, maybe. They were telling me that while they were in the group, they had a nine-year-old girl who was just, you know, playing with, you know, the other kids within the group. And at the age of nine, boys were already much older boys and boys who were kind of like 16, 17, 18 years old were trying to win her heart so that, you know, when it came to it, they would have a wife. This is not a healthy culture. And some of the crimes that happen, you know, under this kind of cover of darkness, it permits genuine sexual predators to it allows them to thrive.
Yeah, doctrinally, to understand, most of the polygamous sects that I'm aware of teach that they are descendants, literal descendants of the lineage of Jesus Christ. Of course, they believe that Jesus was a polygamist, so they have the bloodline of Jesus, which needs to be preserved. But it's sort of like amping up the most racist, you know, thoughts or doctrines you can find and concentrating them in a small group, which would then start justifying all sorts of abhorrent behavior.
You're talking about race as far as bloodline, like...
Yeah, I mean, it's like taking a normal racist dogma and then just concentrating in just a little tiny group of people. Go ahead.
Yeah, that belief that they're fundamentally, they're ultimately descended from Jesus himself is that's what they believe within the order. It's an unspoken belief. I mean, it's an unwritten belief. It's not part of their sort of their teachings, but it's something that is spoken about in church and that they know. It's a kind of a wink that, you know, there is a code to this, and it's created a sort of a caste system within the group. In that there are pure breeds, there are sort of people of sort of noble blood who are pure Kingston for many generations, for example, who are from this family rather than that family. And it has created this kind of aristocracy of DNA, which is, you know, I suppose, related to the fundamental obsession with you know, stratifying society and not fraternizing with the racism against black people, for example, alive and well within the order, you know, absolutely alive and well. In fact, it's quite funny. There was one of the women who told me the story of how she escaped, and this was the subject of a lengthy court process and a very dramatic story, but she's out now, and she was telling me that the N-word was so common in their house that she just didn't realize when she left that it was bad. I mean, she was laughing about it. It was used like, you know, telling the kids to get off the sofa. Stop mm-hmm. acting like
which is
year.
Quite ironic because, I mean, there's not that many people who fit that description in the state of Utah, you know, who would be African-American descent. So you kind of have to go out of your way to actually use the word. You know, it's not like something you trip over all the time.
Yeah. I was wondering, though, before we get off the subject of incest, if there's been any consequences.
You mean like genetic?
Genetic problems that they've encountered?
Yes, there absolutely has. One of the stories I tell that is, it's in the book, but I tell it when just to sort of drive this point home and put people off their lunch a little bit. This story came from Luann Kingston, and it's about. It's not about the prophet's family. It's about another leading member's family who will have to remain nameless. But she said, and she's left now, Luann, and she said that a baby was born to this family that was, because it was such close incest over generations, that it was... I mean, it had no arms or legs. It had a few organs that were barely working. It was kind of a little red quivering lump that stopped quivering pretty soon. And she said that they called the way she described it. She said that it looked kind of like a tomato. What happened was. And this can't be the first time that this has happened. This is a piece of anecdotal evidence. You know, it's like it's one family, one woman. I would suspect that lots and lots and lots of people in the order have similar stories. What they did was essentially they took the tomato out into the backyard, buried it. They tend to deliver all their own children so that events like these don't get reported. So that birth was never recorded, and neither was the death. Mm-hmm. That's very disturbing. That should be looked at, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can tell you from, you know, just the little bit of contact I had while working for the police department is the group is very well lawyered up. And, you know, you have to have all your paperwork in order if you're going to try to serve any sort of warrant or get any sort of access. And I think a lot of law enforcement just sort of throws they shrug, the prosecutors don't like it. And I think maybe this is worth talking about a little bit. I happen to know that the church itself, you know, has long been concerned about the polygamists, especially the polygamists who might be attending regular LDS services or otherwise sort of parasitically living off the big church. And the church still has detectives today whose job it is merely to track the polygamists. So wow. There's been a cat and mouse game going on between the big church and the polygamists since the beginning, really.
That's amazing, isn't it? I love the idea of this cat and mouse, but you're absolutely right about the order being very, legally active. They defend themselves vigorously, in every single case. They're very smart and, you know, you might say cunning in a way, in the way in which they manipulate the press, for example, the court system, to their benefit. You know, you can't really fault them on those grounds. And they have, as many fundamentalist groups do, they have a very strong sense of persecution. And so their skin is very thin, and they're very aggressive about defending themselves. So part of the, much more so than a lot of other groups, while other groups might retreat, they might call foul, they might protest. Ultimately, they don't want to draw attention to themselves. But what happened in the sort of the mid 2000s, was there was a cultural shift within the order in which they decided to go for it, to really fight their case in court, claim that the government was trying to break up their families, that this was a sort of a classic an immoral act. It was un-American. They have religious rights, that they're good, God-fearing people. And they really took that message to the courts in a case of repeated child neglect and alleged abuse, violent abuse by the father, which is a story that I go into in great detail in my book. This is how successful they've been. This should give everybody pause. When the order made that shift, that the trial, the court case, the troubles, the family in question, was the family of John Daniel Kingston and Heidi Foster, one of his many wives. Heidi Foster is, you know, she was the kind of the martyr of the case. Her children were taken away from her because it was alleged that she wasn't looking after them or protecting them from alleged abuse by her husband. Two of her daughters ran away from home, telling the press all kinds of horror stories about what was going on behind closed doors. So this had been going on for a while. Heidi Foster is now, she didn't, you know, shrink behind the curtain after all of this died down, her reputation muddied and all the rest of it. That didn't happen. Heidi Foster is now an active representative of the fundamentalist community on the safety net committee. So she liaises with the state and with other groups, and she represents the cause of fundamentalists. It's astonishing that of all the people to represent your community, it should be somebody whose reputation is so awful. Doesn't seem to matter. You know,
it's, do you think that the confidence that the order shows in their, you know, deciding to fight this stuff out comes from their money and their holdings and the fact that they can hire lawyers and that they have all this, the financial backing to support them?
Yes, I think that's a lot to do with it. I think they're financially very strong. It's very hard to tell exactly how strong. They're certainly not going to reveal their accounts, but part of their financial strength comes from this very insular business. It's kind of a separate economy, the order. They own these various businesses. You mentioned garbage disposal and so on. You know, there's a whole string of them. The people who work in these businesses are order members. They get paid in credits, which they use at order shops. So they don't get paid in cash.
So everything stays in the community. All of their all the money that they could be spending elsewhere stays within their community.
Exactly. And there's a very strict and a very strong ethic within the group to keep as much of your money with the church as possible, or with the co-op as possible. Take as little of it out, spend as little of it, be as thrifty as possible. So I was talking to some people who are working at one of the coal mines in Huntington Canyon. Am I getting that right? The order has had sort of mining businesses in that area for a long time. And so much of that town is are order members. And this guy had been working for something like 20 years down the mine, backbreaking work. And at the time that he left, he was making in the region of $6 an hour, with all of which was paid in credits, which he spent at order stores.
Well, you know, when the Mormons first arrived in Utah, that's sort of how they were running things. They tried to keep finances within the church, and they were often paid not in money, but in store goods from the bishop's storehouse. So it's very, I mean, I'm sure that this is where the Kingstons sort of learned this from.
Yeah, I think these guys aren't particularly innovative. I mean, these methods that they're using, and we can talk about more of them, date back to the main LDS church, who was practicing all this stuff in the 19th century.
Right. And I think that gives it all the kind of heft, that gives it the reason that people, you know, think it's so important. It's a pure consecration, is a very important Mormon sort of practice and tenet. It leaves people really in a mess, though. After a while, they have their entire lives, their incomes, their savings, everything that they possibly have is tied up within this one church. Gives the church incredible power over them, which makes it very, very hard for people to leave. You know, it's difficult to see these people as free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's difficult to leave the main LDS church, as a lot of our listeners know. But to leave one of these enclaves is to literally give up everything. They usually get out with just the shirt on their back, and that's it.
Yeah, often they can't even bring their children with them.
No, and I know of instances from the Kingstons, for example, where you know, girls, especially around about the marrying age, 14, 15, 16, 17, would come to the police or whatever, and they'd say they want out. Usually a brother or an uncle or somebody else would come get them and that sort of thing, take them back home, and then they would disappear. They would be trafficked from one compound to the other across state lines. And even their own closest siblings, their own parents or whoever else, just wouldn't know where they were, because there's this huge network of different locations and farms and compounds and stuff everywhere, and only the highest authority actually knows where all the girls are.
Yeah, it's an incredible thing what happens, the way in which these sort of societies get structured, because it's all happening behind closed doors. This is all happening in the darkness. This is an argument that I try to make in the book, that defenders of polygamy, and there are many of them, they make the same arguments over and over. You know, you shouldn't persecute us. We should have freedom of religion. It's a very wholesome way of living. It's biblical, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Family-oriented.
I'm sorry?
Family-oriented.
Yes, exactly. Feminist, so that one wife can have a job, the other, while another raises their kids, and so people can achieve their potential. And it just sounds dreamy. So in that case, open the doors, you know. Let us in. Be an open society, not a closed one. Let people come and go as they please. Let people choose it. You know, why would you sequester yourself in a remote community, for example, away from everybody else, indoctrinate children into a very particular system of belief, and have them all married off as quickly as possible? That doesn't sound like a confident system to me that can compete in the free market of ideas, which is why I don't have any hesitation in calling them cults. I think I think cults are kind of like flat pornography. You know it when you see it. And these guys are cults. They operate in that way.
Yeah, and I want to circle back to the secrecy, because we've sort of talked about that a few times. It's amazing, because these groups we're talking about, like the Order and some of these others, they're not out in the desert. I think everybody thinks about, these crazy compounds out in the middle of nowhere. These Bountiful and Sandy and some of these places where these guys operate are nice communities that you wouldn't necessarily associate with this sort of thing. And yeah, one of the reasons they've been able to do that is because there is a attitude both by the big church and by the culture in general, the regular LDS culture, that's ashamed about this because of our combined history. As we said, it goes back to the 19th century and Brigham Young, and you can trace all these practices back to the main church. So I think there's a reticence on the part of prosecutors and legislatures and those people to prosecute, because they don't want to bring shame to the LDS church. The LDS church has worked so hard to distance itself, and they still get up there. I mean, it's in my mind, it's a bald-faced lie to say we have nothing to do with polygamy. Of course, they still doctrinally believe in it. But they don't want this stuff coming to light. And I think the reason I'm underlining this is there's a certain cultural complacency with this trafficking and these things that are going on, because the mainline LDS church prosecutors and attorneys and legislatures are allowing it to go on because they don't want to bring shame to the big church.
Absolutely. Hear, hear. I think that the whole polygamy, the terrain of polygamy and the kind of crimes that are going on there, and the narrative that the narrative of the polygamy story is completely defined by the LDS church. It's the seedbed. This is where the doctrines come from. This is where polygamy began. This is where this is the the justification for the way in which these groups operate, however twisted and distorted it may have become, the antipathy between fundamentalists and the LDS Church has defined the polygamous community. The LDS Church is not divorced from this issue in any shape or form. It was very difficult for me to actually contact the LDS Church to talk about this. I mean, you say poly and they cut you off and they say, we have nothing to do with it. You can't even finish the word.
So they wouldn't talk to you about it?
Well, it was very difficult. I did manage it in the end. I managed to speak to somebody called Ron Barney, who at the time was an LDS historian. And so this was, you know, right in there with the temple and the church buildings. And well, he was up on the 15th floor or what, I can't remember, but it was right in the middle of Mormon HQ, right? Mm-hmm. And I was talking to Ron Barney, and it ultimately came down to, I was trying to say, you know, why isn't polygamy a bigger part of the Temple Square experience? You know, why do we not hear so much about the practice?
Like when you go to Brigham Young's home, they don't even mention that he was a polygamist, even though, you know, he had, I don't remember, 50 wives or so. Is that what you mean, that it's not part of Temple Square?
Yes. It's been brushed under the carpet so aggressively, mm-hmm. you know, and I think Brigham Young was over 60 wives, and the prophet Joseph Smith had over 30. I mm-hmm. mean, who knows? And I was trying to ask him, I said, well, this is incredibly significant to their lives and to Mormon history and to Mormon belief. And yet you can look all over Temple Square and really see no mention of it. What's going on? Why is the church shy of this issue? Why don't they just grab the nettle and deal with it? And his answer really boiled down to two words, you know, public relations. He said people can't handle when they hear polygamy, they'll just obsess over that, and that'll be the only thing they look at when there's all this other stuff we want to talk about when it comes to the LDS Church. So we think people can't handle it. And I just think, no, people can. You can't. That's really the problem. You can't. You're conflicted about it. You don't know what you want to say about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the issue. They really don't have a stand. People say, why doesn't the church just come clean with their past? I've heard my liberal friends say that. Because they don't know what to come clean to. They don't know what to. And there's been so many years of, oh, just throwing sand in everybody's eyes and reversing position and burying data that they just have no idea what to even own up to.
Well, they don't, like Sanjeev said, they don't want to be associated with polygamy. So if they say the word polygamy, then automatically they're associated with it again. They're reminding everybody of their history that they don't want people to think about. So the only solution they can see is to just not mention it.
So I have a question. I know that with the FLDS, well, let me back up. To practice polygamy, you have a problem, and that's too many men. So you always have to have a way to reduce the head count of the men. For the FLDS, it's sort of well-documented, well-known, that they tend to shun boys when they're about 14, 15, 16. And in fact, a large number of, from what I understand, I've read from a couple sources, a large number of, say, male prostitutes in the Las Vegas area are the lost boys, the boys who've been kicked out of the compound. I'm not so familiar about what the other segments, you know, the TLC or some of these other groups do to reduce the male head count. Do you have any insight into that?
Well, I don't think it's quite as stark as the Lost Boy story, because I think the Lost Boy story is easy to get a handle on because the FLDS community is so hermetic. You know, they're in one place, and when the boys get rejected, thrown out, then they move literally to another place. They're no longer living in that house or on that street. They are literally shunted out into the wide world. And so it's a very sort of stark, easy to kind of comprehend process. With with some of the other groups, because they're a little bit more amorphous, a little bit more marbled into the, you know, general society, for example, like the Order, it's harder to kind of isolate particular cases. And it's harder to see this kind of like movement of males from one group to another because they just bleed out. And,
well, you mentioned earlier about a 9-year-old being, you know, courted by older teenage boys, and it almost sounded like they were desperate to get some kind of female as a wife. Well, yeah, some kind of wife to stay in the community, because if they didn't have a wife, then they weren't really part of the community. Is that sort of why they were doing that?
Yeah, there's an enormous amount of competition for wives. I mean, with the in the case of the Order, for example, there's a lot of stories that circulate around the Order of boys who essentially become sort of disenfranchised. They if you're not married within the Order, then your life hasn't really begun. And in the caste system, the very sort of strict kind of hierarchy of where you stand in the cult's kind of recognition, unmarried men are the lowest of the low, really. They're just sort of chattel. They are labor. They are nothing. You have no life, and you're definitely not going to the celestial kingdom. So your whole world is kind of in the balance if you can't get onto the marriage ladder. And this has a terrible effect on their psychology. And so you mentioned that there are male prostitutes and so on, that lost boys, you know, they are genuinely lost. And the same thing happens with in the Order. There are lots of stories of people who leave the group and because there is no life for them in the group, and they think that they are lost and God hates them. There's a lot of drugs and attempted suicide and all kinds of problems.
And I don't mean to go circle back to the big church again, but I happen to know that if you were raised as a polygamist and convert to the church, you need a general authority's permission to go on a mission. I know of a particular case like that. Like they're shunned even in the main church. So you're kind of left out in the cold, you know?
Yeah, I think that there are so many parallels to the main church. And I think that's the transition from one to the other is it's a matter of degree. But it's not a different. These aren't different categories of experience. I think they're the same sorts of things. And the you're very familiar with the ex-Mormon community, which is a very passionate community. And that a lot of the language that I hear from ex-Mormons has the same sort of color of the people who have left these really very extreme groups. Talking about really finding out who they are for the first time and recognizing the freedom that they have in making choices that they never considered before, and understanding who other people are, and reorienting their sort of their sense of their place in the universe. I mean, these huge cosmic shifts are sort of happening. Lifestyle changes go along with them. There's this enormous liberation, which can be dangerous. Mm-hmm. Because they're not really prepared for it. But at the same time, the kind of happiness that can come out at the other end is genuine. It's not sanctioned. It's not codified. It's real. And there are some tremendous stories. I mean, there was a girl called Angie who was part of the TLC, who it was a bit of journalistic good fortune. I showed up poking around, asking people personal questions. And it turned out that she was on the verge of leaving. It was a big secret in the group. She was married to the prophet at the time, James Harmston. And she was completely conflicted about this. She thought she was going to be cursed. You know, she really had that completely indoctrinated mindset. She was terrified. But long story short, she left. It was a very dramatic episode in her life. She went from thinking that God would punish her for this. Literally, she had dreams, terror dreams. She thought that they were revelations in which her car would crash, her children would die, all these terrible things. She believed that the prophet could do this to her. She went from that mindset to one now where she is fully independent and loving life, loving her independence. And I see her her posts on Facebook, and it just makes me smile every time. I just think, I wish that that story was more common.
We've talked about some of the most egregious cases, which I think are very important to focus in on. But there's another segment of polygamists, the polygamist underground, which is these folks who are not really as culty in their behavior. They're more independent. I think people would be most familiar with Cody Brown and his family, you know, from the reality TV show. We've met some others that are around like that. So, and I think one of the spokesmen for that community is Ann Wilde, who's out there. She was the wife of Ogden Kraut before he passed away. So there's this other polygamist underground that oftentimes functions inside the church also. Let's talk about those guys for a minute, because I think they're kind of interesting.
Oh, they are. They're very interesting. There are all these sorts of shades of gray, you know, that I don't think you're considered an official group until you have a certain number of people. And some groups are just literally individual families. They may grow or they may fragment over the course of a generation or two. They have these very sort of organic kind of stories. But again, it's not a category difference. Some of these, you know, the Kingston family, for example, began as independents. They just managed to create a fiefdom, lots and lots of people, very huge families, and then before you know it, there's thousands of them, and you could call them a cult. Independents are this kind of, they flit in and out of the landscape, you know, the sort of the Mormon polygamist terrain, but there are lots and lots and lots of them, and this tells me that this Mormon stuff is strong potion. You know, it really works. And when people have these kind of revelations, when they get that sense that there's more to this, there's the original beliefs, let's go back to the fundamentals. Once that process begins, it just grabs people by the throat. You know, families do break up over this, though.
Once, yeah, yeah. Zilpha and I were talking to some polygamists a couple weeks ago, a month or so ago, and I asked him, I said, well, what made you decide? Because none of them were born into the polygamist sex.
They were
raised
mainstream.
They were raised completely mainstream LDS. And he said, well, I read the Doctrine and Covenants.
And it says right in there that we have to be polygamists.
So the church, the main church, is still actively spitting out polygamists. Because it's still right there in the scriptures. You know, you don't have to have a long history with the LeBarons or the Kingstons or anything. You can just read the scriptures and decide to be a polygamist. And these guys, some of these guys are dangerous because these guys were trolling adult sort of hookup sites. You know, they're not like fully dating sites. They're sort of sites that are people looking a little bit more for flings. They were actively looking for damaged women in order to bring them in as sister wives. You know, so even if you're independent, even if you don't have a full-on cult structure and you're not trafficking in slave labor, there's still this icky element of it that's sort of preying on society.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And this preying on damaged women from the LDS Church is, you know, there's a story in my book about somebody who you may be familiar with. He's not strictly a polygamist, but he kind of nibbles at the fringes of fundamentalism. And he's called Chris Nemelka.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Yes, yes, exactly. So, well, Chris Nemelka was, he had a polygamist phase. It didn't last very long, but he considers himself, you know, a great teacher on these things. I think his followers believe him to be a kind of a prophet of some sort. But the story that I tell is around the period of about sort of 2000, when he would go to dances, LDS dances, and literally pick up women there for his cause. And he picked up one called Christine Marie. And she fitted the profile of so many women that I met who fall into fundamentalism at a certain period of their lives. And they've been, you know, if you eloquently put it, spat out by the LDS. What had happened is that they'd had this very LDS upbringing. They'd become a sort of a Molly Mormon kind of wife, a kind of an overachieving Mormon wife mm-hmm. with a perfect family, etc. And then it all fell apart. And it can fall apart in sort of horrible, traumatic ways. Divorce is always, you know, a major life trauma. But when your whole life is about your marriage and your children, and you have no life other than marriage and children, if that's it, then it leaves them incredibly wounded mm-hmm. and also abandoned by the church. And so they have these dances where they're looking for this kind of a good Mormon man to kind of like make it all right again. And here are these kind of like strange, you know, extremist, sort of slightly psychologically kind of askew characters like Christopher Nemelka, who speaks in scripture. You know, he really, he knows his Doctrine and Covenants, you know, he knows his Book of Mormon, and there he is. He's just ready to scoop you up and take you to the next level. Very often when a system of belief, when people suffer from a system of belief, because of that sort of rationalization that you make when it's your belief system, that you can't let that belief system go just because it hasn't treated you well, people very often double down. You know, we see this, it's just a very common thing. It's a psychologically common thing for people to do, that, you know, the reason your prayers haven't come true is because you're not praying hard enough. Mm-hmm. Not because prayer doesn't work, because you haven't done it well enough. So you sort of double down. And that happens, I think, to a lot of women in the kind of midlife crisis. They've hit a crisis. They're in their sort of 40s. And they have all that sort of that fear that women have at that age, that they don't have a family, they don't have a husband, you know, they're old maids, what's to become of them, God doesn't like them, and, you know, maybe they've sinned, maybe they've just been bad, maybe they haven't been Mormon enough. And it's a dangerous road. The TLC was one of the groups that had a lot of these women.
Yeah, well, we were reading, Zilf and I were reading in a evolutionary psychology book a few months ago, and they talked about the psychology of married men being more attractive to women sometimes because they've already been picked. They're safe, right? They've already been
sort of a known commodity.
It's a known quantity. There's another woman who's validated them. And if you're in that situation where, like you say, marriage defines who you are as an LDS, as a mainstream LDS woman, marriage and family is everything, you find yourself without a family. Here is this family unit that provides you both the saving family, and even more so because they're amping up the rhetoric than on that.
Yeah.
But there's already women there who are saying, no, this is the greatest thing ever. I think if you are in that damaged state, it could seem so seductive. It could seem like such a big thing. I'm just reminded of all those communes that started in the 60s and 70s and failed. They all were so, utopian and idealistic. And I think a lot of people entering into this sort of take that LDS the normal LDS venue, and it seems so perfect and so crystal clean. And the rest of us, it just seems nuts.
And messy.
Yes. And the degree to which you can be seduced in that sort of fragile state is incredible. You know, it's this, the appeal of something can just confirm for you that you're right in your wish to double down, you know, in your wish to really, really push the limits. That this was, when you feel lost, you look for purpose. And purpose can be a terrible thing. the story of Christine, for example, when she fell into sort of the world of Nemelka, she believed that she was his chosen wife, you know, he was Joseph and she was Emma kind of thing. There were lots of other women sort of in Chris's life at that time she didn't know about. Within about 9 months, she'd gone through this astonishing arc in which she had sold her body in order to pay for Nemelka's lifestyle, essentially. It wasn't a lovely lifestyle, but he wasn't working. He needed to fund his, he was doing this translation work, heavily in inverted commas. And Christine was selling her body for him. And this happened within months of meeting at this LDS dance.
Wow.
It was just, and again, what do you do? You have two grown adults, to educated adults making conscious choices, and you just have to, you have to let them do it. But it's a dysfunctional world where things like that sort of happen, and I think it's very difficult for people in that position to wake up and regard themselves as victims of something, because it's difficult to know. I was standing with Christine in a Mormon bookshop, and she was looking at all of these, you know, Mormon texts and papers and so on. She was crying. She was saying, but this stuff is all so good. How could this have led to me? I mean, I don't understand. I can't abandon all this.
That's sort of how John feels in a used bookstore.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I think this leads to, you know, something that's important to call to out to the world. I think there is a certain, I don't know, disgust factor with the whole thing, which sort of pushes it to the underground. I think we all need to sort of labor to bring this into the light. And I think one of the things that needs to be done is we probably need to formalize these relationships. I mean, we probably need to make them legally acknowledged.
Wow, I'm so happy to hear that. I thought it was all on my own on that one. Some sort of freak, sort of pseudo-libertarian, liberal kind of weirdo. But you don't make a lot of friends, really, by saying, you know, I think we should decriminalize polygamy. I think we should ratify it. I mean, the government's in my marriage. Why can't it be in theirs? I mean, the government really, if ever there was a marriage system where the government really ought to be paying some attention, it's the polygamous marriage system. Why do they get to live in secrecy? Why can't they? Why don't they have to sign forms and, you know, and everybody can kind of have that sort of that representation, as you say, because it opens a society up. I think there are so many good arguments for decriminalization, and all of them are very unpopular. But I think that criminalization creates the problem that it's trying to. Very often, it creates a problem it's trying to solve.
It makes it more secretive, and opens it up for more abuses.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's working perfectly for sexual criminals, power hungry prophets, and perpetrators and tyrants. It's working great for them, you know, mm-hmm. because they have this. It turns them into victims of the evil state instead of the criminals that they are. It terrifies witnesses from coming forward. It makes martyrs of the very worst people in their societies. It victimizes the people within those societies. And it doesn't help in catching the actual bad guys. I mean, I don't think there is a kind of a squeamishness about, you know, this idea of having more than one wife. I think you're right about that. But I do think that the arrows are pointing towards greater liberalization. I think that the trend is towards a greater acceptance of that kind of thing.
It works for some people. It really, honestly, I mean, they enjoy that lifestyle. Their children aren't, you know, maladjusted or abused. I'm not saying that. I think.
You mean there's a set of people who thrive underneath it?
Yeah, that it's okay for.
Likely with any sort of polyamorous configuration, there's most of them don't work and some of them could work. And you can say that for like monogamous marriage too,
well,
right?
Yeah.
You know, to be completely honest with you, Sanjeev, my opinion is that the state needs to get out of the marriage business altogether. But if they're going to sanction it and recognize it, You know, the, it's just like marijuana or any or the prohibition against alcohol, where there is market demand and there's criminalization. You create a black market, and then people thrive off that. And we've talked about this martyr complex and this idea that we're being picked on,
and the
that,
secrecy.
And they use that as sort of a saying, "This is God's work. You can tell because nobody else likes it."
Right.
And I think if you take that out, it sort of takes away some of their claws.
Oh, absolutely! Yeah, it takes away their power, and it also does. It removes that sort of aspect of sort of social judgment. It leans further towards personal responsibility, which is something that I think, as a society, we are tilting more and more towards. You know, I think the sort of the younger generation, for example, the old bugbears. That used to upset conservatives, you know, social conservatives like gays, for example. They're kind of, you know, gays, divorce, single moms. You know, these things are kind of, they were stigmas at one point. They were sins. These people were sort of looked down upon. That is happening less and less and less. And I think the younger generation now really are, I think, according to polls, are almost overwhelmingly in favor of gay marriage, for example. It's not even an issue to them. Mm-hmm. And I think polygamy is going to be kind of, it's next, you know, it is the next kind of barrier to be broken down. But I think the broader principle is the one that's at play, really. It's not because people like polygamy or they like gays. It's this, they don't like the judgment. Just get out of our relationships.
Right. These are adults. Well, they should be.
Well, I mean, that points to the central dichotomy, of course, we've been talking about last hour. You know, the problem is not two adults or three adults or seven adults who want to enter into whatever household configuration they want. It's the children. It's the oppression. It's the same sins that have been going on for 4,000 or 5,000 years, you know, slavery and human trafficking and manipulation and all that kind of stuff. It has nothing to do with who's sleeping with whom. And once we figure that out, then we can get to the root of the real problem.
Exactly. Yeah. I, you know, from your lips to God's ears. not that I believe in God, I don't, but, you know, figuratively.
Right, right. Well, Sanjeev, it's been a fascinating conversation. And you know, that all these groups, the genealogies are endless. And we, of course, only scratch the surface. But it's this fascinating underground that's right here alive. In the heart of Zion.
Do you want to give a plug for your book?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've really enjoyed talking to you both. It's been a really, really fun conversation. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. The book's called Secrets and Wives, The Hidden World of Mormon Polygamy. And you can find out all about it on my website, which is sanjivb.com, sanjivb.com.
Great, and we'll put a link up on our website, and
also on Sanjeev's website is a link. I believe there's a link to the Doug Fabrizio interview from last year.
That's true. Yes.
Interested in listening to that one? Thanks, Sanjeev.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much.